Now, I've been asked just at the beginning to mention two or three books that you might like to buy. You've given me a hard job, really, because the first time I've seen some of these books. But, of course, after this morning, I would have to recommend this book on William Carey by Daniel Webber. I have to confess to you, I have never read it, but I've only just glanced at it. But it does seem to me to be very comprehensive, and I'm sure you will benefit from reading that. This other one is well known. It's been around a long time. J.C. Ryle, Christian Leaders of the 18th Century. And I recommend that because we've been in the 18th century this morning and we'll be in the 18th century this afternoon. And some of the figures that you probably already know are mentioned in the list here. George Whitefield, Wesley, Grimshaw, Romaine, Berridge and so on. They're all figures that our friend here, Selina, Countess of Huntingdon, would have known. So that will fill in a bit more background if you want to do that. And then staying with J.C. Ryle, I see that there is a fairly new book come out by Ian Murray, but I like the title, Prepare to Stand Alone, Dare to Be a Daniel, Dare to Stand Alone. And if there was ever a need for that, it's today, isn't it? And we find ourselves often standing alone. But we know that the Lord is with us, and one with God is a majority. So this is a good book to read about a man who dared to stand alone, and we can learn a lot from that. So that's all I'll say on the books, but all books are good to read. Somebody said, what book should you read? And somebody said, everything. Well, there's a lot in it, really, but you have to be careful, don't you? Now, our subject this afternoon is Selina, Countess of Huntingdon. She lived from 1707 to 1791, so she nearly, throughout that century, she was there. Now, one or two verses anyway. Now, one was pretty well a verse that she often quoted. And this was in the 1 Corinthians, first chapter, and verse 26. This was a verse that she, as I say, often drew people's attention to. Here it is, verse 26. For you see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. And she said that she thanked God for this text, especially the letter M. Especially the letter M. Because it doesn't say, it says, not many, not any, if you see what I mean. And she was rich in this world, goods and so on. So she liked the M in that. And then another text that she often mentioned was in the third chapter of the same epistle, verse 9. For we are laborers together with God. Ye are God's husbandry. Ye are God's building. According to the grace of God which is given unto me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation and another man buildeth thereon. But let every man take heed how he buildeth thereupon. For other foundation can no man lay than that is laid, which is Christ Jesus. And that's a good foundation, the only foundation. Now, having said that, we have to say and mention and underline the vital place that women, ladies, have been given, responsibility given to them in the building of the Church of God, the extension of the Kingdom of God. And right from the Old Testament, we could be talking about Miriam, or Deborah, or Hannah, or Elizabeth, or Mary, or Priscilla, and so it would go on. And all the way through church history, it goes on with the Monicas, and the Mother of Augustine, and the great ladies of the Reformation. I notice there's a book on that theme as well on the book table. And Susanna Wesley, and Selina, Countess of Huntingdon, and Fanny Crosby, whose words we've just been singing. And so you could go on. Now, you could say this about our friend this afternoon. Without her, without her support, and certainly without her prayers, and certainly without her influence, the work of those great leaders of the revival, Wesley and Whitefield, Whitefield and Wesley, however you want to say it, would have been very much more difficult. We don't realize that. We acknowledge the power of the Spirit of God in these men, and that is the essential thing. But in everyday terms, this woman played a most significant role. She was unobtrusive. She was profoundly consecrated to the work of God, and she was consistent all the way through her saved life in this work, self-sacrificing to the limit. She virtually bankrupted herself. She was a rich woman, but she literally gave all that she had, certainly financially, and by way of time and by way of commitment. So she's an outstanding example of a lady who served God. Now, she was born on the 24th of August, as we say, 1707. Queen Anne was on the throne, and it was the year of the union of the English and Scottish parliaments. There are two places that claim to be her birthplace. I don't know which one is the right one. Some say she was born in Ashwell House, which is now referred to as a castle, in Northamptonshire. That's the same county that our friend this morning, Mr. Carey, was born in. And others say she was born in Staunton Harold. I've never heard of the place, but it's in Leicestershire. It was a village in which Nigel Lawson, who was the late Chancellor, lived. Just by a bit of extra information that's not really relevant. But there it is. Now, her father was called Washington Shirley. That was her father's name. He was the second Earl of Ferrers, a distant relative of the famous George Washington, and so on. Her mother was Mary Lavinch, daughter of Sir Richard Lavinch, who was the Solicitor General for Ireland and Speaker of the House of Commons, and the family had estates in Carrick, Macross, in County Monaghan. So you see something of the background of this woman. She was a member of what we call the gentry, and there she was. Now, from a child, she was very pious, quiet, very religious, serious-minded, and as she grew into womanhood and she had to go out into what they call society in those days, mix with all these other high-flying women and lords and ladies and so on, she found the whole experience, though she went along with it because of her position and for her husband's sake, but she found the whole thing nauseating, really. She didn't like these so-called fashionable parties. She saw they were hollow. They were empty. It was show. It was vain. And she would much rather, whilst these things were going on, though she was civil with people and did her best, she would much rather have been on her own reading, and especially the Word of God. So that's how she was. But she's not converted yet through this time. Another early sign of what God was going to do with her was the a time when the orphanage, or the refuge for children, we might call it, was founded in 1731. There was a man called Thomas Coram, you may have heard of him, and he founded the famous Foundling Hospital. This, in a way, was a kind of a first fruit, a kind of an anticipation of what was coming, because nobody cared tums about foundlings or orphans at that time. It was a very irreligious and a very immoral and a very selfish period of history coming into the 1730s. There was no sign of a revival. It was as bad as it is today. But, you know, this man has it on his heart. No doubt the Lord had laid it there. And our friend Selina, she gets mixed up with this. She wants to help. And they wanted to get, I must go on with that, this is a long story, but she wanted to get the king's signature on the papers to do with the founding of it. When they advertised it, I suppose, it would be good for it to have, you know, favoured by, supported by King George II, as it was then. And they had to pay legal fees, they had to get solicitors, they had to pay stamp duties, they had to have it all written down on special vellum paper, they had to have seals, all manner of expenses. She paid the lot. So without that, there would never have been the Foundling Hospital in London at that time. Now, she gets married, 1728, she gets married, And she married a fellow by the name of Theophilus Hastings. Philosophus Hastings, he was the Earl of Huntingdon. He could trace his descent back to King Edward IV. So he's royal blood flowing in his veins. He's at the very top of society. And he was renowned for his moral integrity. He wasn't, as far as I know, a born-again Christian. But in a day of dissolute morals, as we'll talk about in a minute, he stood out as being a man of great integrity and principle. So they were married. I ought to just say that they had to rub shoulders with two other notorious figures of that day amongst the gentry. One was Lord Chesterfield, and the other was Lord Bolingbroke. If you know anything about this man, Chesterfield, both these fellows were brilliant in their minds and intellect, but they were the lowest of the low when it came to morality. Chesterfield, he actually wrote a book on seduction, how to, as a lord or member of the gentry, how to seduce an innocent woman. Fancy writing a book on that. So that was the sort of fellows they were. And Lady Selina's husband had to deal with them, but he was never contaminated by their way of life at all. And we're going to say in a while, she managed to get those two fellows to come and hear Whitfield preach. And I'll tell you what they said about him afterwards. So here we are setting the scene. And what brought Lady Selina into the gospel and into the revival was the fact that her husband's two sisters married two, we can use the word cautiously, Methodist ministers. I know the word Methodist, sadly, has not got that quality about it as it used to have. But these were two evangelical, you may say, perhaps, ministers. And Margaret Hastings, that was the sister, she married a man called Benjamin Ingham, which is well known at that time. He's said to have been the founder of Yorkshire Methodism. So that was a sister-in-law. And the other sister-in-law, Lady Catherine Hastings, she married an equally devout Methodist, but not so well known. He was the Reverend Mr. Wheeler. But these two figures, and particularly the first one, Lady Margaret, she saw it as her business, first priority, to witness to her own family. And that's where she began at the beginning. And that's how Selina came to be converted. Now, she goes on from this. I've got a little quote here. I'm tempted just to give you the first line. This is what she said. "Now the day began to dawn," she said. This is her Christian life. "Jesus, the Son of Righteousness, arose and burst in meridian splendor on my benighted soul." So there's a whole lot of this testimony which I can't read, but can't have the time to read. But she has a wonderful conversion experience. And the people that she was associated with at that time were utterly dismayed, taken aback, couldn't believe that she had identified herself with these ridiculous Methodists and these evangelical types and religious types. They couldn't believe it, that such a woman in her position could do this. Now, her husband, he was a bit taken aback as well. And he was a little bit dubious about what had happened to her. And he didn't object. He was that sort of a man. But he did run away off to the Bishop of Gloucester and told him, his name was Dr. Benson, he said, my wife has joined these Methodists. Is this okay, sort of thing? Is this normal? Well, what am I to do about it? And Dr. Benson didn't really give him a proper answer, I don't think. But he then persuaded his wife. I think Dr. Benson must have said, well, try and persuade her to come and see me. So he did, and she went. And she went and spoke to him, and she began to say that she believed in every one of the 39 articles of the Church of England, just as he was supposed to do anyway. She made that very plain, and she defended her position from scriptures. And then how did Dr. Benson react? He confessed that he had been a little perturbed about what she'd said, and he regretted the fact that he had ordained a few years earlier a certain George Whitfield, who was the cause of all this, humanly speaking, and wondered about it. And she said to him, because he expressed his concern to her, she replied to the bishop, "Sir, mark my words, when you are on your dying bed, that will be one of the few ordinations you have made that you will reflect upon with complacency, with compliance, with pleasure," in other words, she means. And so she was quite bold. As it happened, must have got diverted here, but when the bishop himself came to be dying, he sent for George Whitfield to come and minister to him. So she had an effect right away on that man, the bishop of Gloucester. Now, after this, she heard that both John and Charles Wesley were preaching nearby to where she was living. And immediately she wrote to them, contacted them, and gave them a very warm greeting and said, you know, she would be supporting them in all that they did. She didn't know them very well at that point, but that's how she first came into contact with her. It seems to be going well, but in her life, there were going to be many, many trials. All in the world, you shall have tribulation. And the first manifestation of this was, I mentioned this Lord Chesterfield a few minutes ago, a dissolute, ungodly man. He began to have an influence on one of Lady Selina's sons. I think she had six children. And this young fellow was totally taken in by him and went the way of Lord Chesterfield. That was a heartbreaking experience for her right at the very beginning of her Christian life. And another thing happened to her. Her cousin had married a fellow, his name was Lawrence Shirley, who very, very badly treated his wife. I'm telling you, these people were coming right out of the world while I'm telling you this diversion. This fellow, cousin's husband, he very badly treated her. And in the end, he got so violent that the authorities forced him to divorce his wife. We don't agree with divorce, I know, but this was so bad that they separated the couple. Now, the steward of this man's estate, he sent £50 out of the estate funds to the estranged wife, who was suffering with no money or anything. He sent it. Anyway, when this man, Lawrence Shirley, found out the steward had done this, he got hold of him and accused him of misappropriation of funds, made him kneel down on the ground and shot him in cold blood. He was later hanged for doing it, which was quite right. But this was going on in this godly woman's life right at the very beginning. All kinds of troubles were all around her. Not only that, but when she was 39, her husband died, left her a widow. And what was she to do? She's now a Christian. She is now coming into contact with all these leaders of the 18th century revival. What is she to do? She pondered, shutting herself away to bemoan her lot, just minding her own business, as it were. Mind you, minding her own business. There were large estates to run, tremendous load of practical, ordinary management fell upon her at this moment. But what did she do? She believed that the Lord was telling her that she had a drawing room. We can have a drawing room, but she had a drawing room probably as big as this room, sort of thing. And she saw it as an opportunity to, copying her sister-in-law's perhaps, to invite all her friends into it to hear the gospel. And at first, she persuaded Howell Harris, the famous Welsh preacher, to come along and minister to a group of all the lords and ladies and gentry that she knew, a considerable lot of people, as big a congregation as is here this afternoon. And so Howell Harris preached to them. George Whitefield at this time was in America, at the orphanage there in Savannah. But when he came back, she also persuaded him to come and to preach to this gathering of lords and ladies that she managed to persuade to come along. Now, in the famous book by Dalimore on George Whitefield, he actually lists all the names of the gentry, men and women, that she managed to get to come along to these meetings. Now, I haven't got time to read all these names, but I'll give you a visual aid, because that's one page of them, and this is another page of them. And if I was to read just the first two lines, for instance, Lady Fanny Shirley, who was known as one of the reigning beauties of the court of George I, the Duchess of Argyll, Lady Betty Campbell, Lady Ferrers, Lady Sophia Thomas, the Duchess of Montague, who just goes on and on again of all the, you know, that anybody who was anybody of that time. And George Whitefield had to preach to them. He said this, "I go with fear and trembling, knowing how difficult it is to speak to the great so as to win them to Jesus Christ. I am sometimes ready to say, Lord, I pray thee have me excused and ascend by whom thou wilt." Well, he dreaded it because these people, I mentioned a few minutes ago, Bolingbroke and Chesterfield, on several occasions, these dissolute individuals were there in the drawing room to speak. Now, Chesterfield, as well as being a bad character, he was known as a brilliant orator. He was called the British Cicero. So you've got to speak in front of the fellow who's been acclaimed as the greatest orator in the land. It's somewhat daunting, isn't it? You know, whenever you get up to speak in public, it's daunting. But when you know the caliber of the people, and these people are going to be critical right from the start, you know, you're not going to have a sympathetic audience or congregation. Anyway, what did Chesterfield say about Whitefield when he preached? He said this, he said, "Mr. Whitefield's eloquence is unrivaled, his zeal inexhaustible, and not to admire both would argue total absence of taste and insensibility not to be coveted by anybody." So he said, Whitefield, brilliant orator. That's a brilliant orator saying to another man, brilliant orator. But spiritually, he was totally and utterly unmoved and never did come to faith. But his wife, who, by the way, was the daughter of King George I, that was Chesterfield's wife, she was converted by Whitefield's preaching in one of these gatherings together. I could spend all afternoon naming people that were converted. Perhaps one of the most well-known would be George Frederick Handel. We sometimes forget he was converted under Whitefield's ministry. And if you go to see his grave, it's on it, "I know that my Redeemer liveth," the famous oratorio, but his personal experience of faith. And sometimes, if you look at the names of the hymn tunes, the writers of the hymn tunes, you sometimes see the name Gardini. Gardini, an Italian. You think, well, who was he? Well, you find out that he was an Italian writer of operas and so on. But he also was converted in the drawing room of Lady Huntingdon. And you'll see some hymn tunes, if you look carefully, Gardini. And that was the fellow that was converted at this time. Now, by the way, while I'm talking about hymns, Lady Huntingdon had her own hymn book produced. I'll tell you why. It had 730 hymns in it, and the way it was laid out was very interesting. It says something else about her. Now, when you go to any ordinary hymn book, this is a good hymn book, I hasten to say. I'm not being critical, but most hymn books, they begin with God. God in his glory, his majesty, the attributes of God, and then Christ and all that he did, and then the Holy Spirit, and then the Word of God, and so on, and the various aspects of the Christian life. It's all good. I always think you should begin with God. So does the Bible. And that's right. But Lady Huntingdon's book is set out along the lines of Christian experience. It begins with the sinner under conviction. False and full of sin I am, and so on. And then it goes on to the first stirrings of faith. And then it goes on to faith in its reality, and so on. Then it goes on to various trials and tribulations. And so it's all the experience of the Christian life. It's very interesting the way it's set out. If you get a copy of John Wesley's hymns from the very first, it's in the same way set out. But it's interesting. And so this woman had a great insight into the workings of God in her own heart and in the hearts of men and women all around her. Now, her wouldn't want you to think that this lady was a prude. You know, she wasn't sort of a holier-than-thou person, individual woman. Early in life, this is before she was converted, I hasten to add, she and several other women, by all I can say is by trickery and perhaps by flattery, she managed to get into the House of Commons. No women were allowed in those days, but they somehow got in to protest about something, some bill that was going through the Commons. She was probably a forerunner of the suffragettes, but I'm just trying to say this is a very determined woman, again, rather like William Carey. So I just throw that in as we're passing. Now, the authorities, the Church of England, that is, the Anglican authorities, by this time were becoming not so favourable, I might say at the least, to the preaching of Whitfield and Wesley and these other revival leaders. And why didn't these people, these bishops and archbishops, why didn't they succeed? They could have silenced those men. Now, part of the reason takes us back to William of Orange and the Bill of Rights and so on. But I won't go into that now, but we recognize it. It's important. But another reason was because of the influence of Selina, Countess of Huntingdon. And she had the ear of both King George II and King George III, who succeeded him. And when these people, these bishops, complained to the king about the activities of the good lady and those she supported, King George II is said to have replied, "Make 'em bishops, make 'em bishops." So they didn't get anywhere with him. And when it came to George III, just showing the influence of Lady Huntingdon again, a similar thing happened. They complained to the king. And again, he said the same thing. "Make 'em bishops, make 'em bishops," he said. But then the queen butted in at that point, no doubt with very good manners. But she said this. I wouldn't have used these words, but this is what she said. She said, "It would be a lucky circumstance if she could, she puts you all to shame." And what she was trying to say is, you know, you're trying to stop these men, but they put you all to shame. And then the king replied, "I wish there was a Lady Huntingdon in every diocese of the country." So again, they didn't get anywhere by complaining to the king. I'll give you one other quote from George III. He said about Lady Huntingdon, "There is something so noble, so commanding, so engaging about her that I am quite captivated by her ladyship. She is an honour to her sex and to the nation." So this is the sort of influence this woman had. And we do believe George III was converted as well. I don't know whether through the ministry of the Lady Huntingdon or not, but somehow he was. Now, the next thing we want to think about is the vast extent, the vast amount that this woman did. Now, I dare say we're not all peers of the realm here, and we may not have the resources or the finance or the influence that she had. But what she had, she used with all her might. What she had, she used with all her might. In Sunday school, we used to sing, search for it, find it, God's holy work, it never is far away. Find it by doing with heart and with soul the duties that call each day. And we all know what they are, and they grow as we use them and we exercise them. And she did that. She didn't always know what to do at the beginning, but whatever her hand findeth to do, as it were, found to do, she did it with all her might. Part of it was she laboured in prayer, and she spent a great deal of time in prayer, and especially before these meetings that were held in her drawing room. She would pour out her soul that the preacher, whether it was Harold Harris or George Whitfield or whoever it was, he would have the words to say, that the power of the Spirit behind him. And she knew all these things. And when it was over, she would pray that there were those souls, those seeds sown, that would come up a rich harvest. This was a very spiritual woman indeed. Now, she had six children. William Carey had seven. She had six, and one of them was off the rails, as we said. I don't know about all the others. And she had these extensive estates to run. She was a great manager of affairs. This is going to come into the Christian work later on. But she had to manage all these estates. And one of the things she was doing, of course, though, was using that position to make known the gospel to those who lived on those estates. She would visit the tenants. She would pray with the tenants. This would have been unique in that time. Any of them that were poor, she would help. Any of them that were sick, she would get a doctor and so on. So this is the way, in practical terms, she lived her everyday life. She had homes in different parts of the country, I might tell you. She had a place in Brighton in those days. And she heard of a woman, a widow, who had had a child. And this widow was dying and was more or less destitute. So she went to visit her, just in her own home. And she went into the home. She ministered to the woman. But in this hovel that she was living in, the walls were so thin. In fact, they had holes in, so you could see the next door. And the next door was a kind of a bakery, where there were ovens, and poor people could take their dough and bake it in the oven. And so there was often quite a few women there waiting to use the oven. And then the countess realized that as she was ministering to this dying woman, the people next door were all listening to her. And she ended up with a large congregation of people in the room next door. And she stayed there for several weeks because there was a work to do there. And so this is the kind of a woman that saw opportunities, found them. They were thrust upon her, wherever she went. Now, not only was she doing all these sort of practical, everyday things, she's got a wide vision. It's good. Where there is no vision, the people perish. And she has a vision. She starts to think about the universities. Now, we should be thinking about the universities, because we all know what goes on in the universities these days, apart from so-called learning. We have to be careful. But she grasps this, that from the universities would come the next leaders of the country, as it were. And so she has a particular interest and care for the universities. Now, in that time, it was a bit different than what it is now, because she said this. She said, at our universities, Oxford and Cambridge, she was talking about, she said, there are so many that are determined to be on the Lord's side. Well, you couldn't say that now, could you? There are so many in our universities that are determined to be on the Lord's side. And she was going to help them to be that. Today is something we should bear in mind. There are so many in our universities that are not on the Lord's side, and it bodes ill for the future. But she had this vision to see where the influence was coming from. Another thing that she did, and we can all learn from, is that she was good at networking, getting to know people, influencing people in that sense. And she, in a very few years, got to know all the main leaders of the revival, the main ministers that were up and down the country. And she had contact with them. She went to see them. She wrote to them. She helped them financially, all kinds of things on her list. First was Isaac Watts, although he was quite elderly by this time. Philip Doddridge, William Remain, Henry Venn, Roland Hill, John Fletcher, many, many others were on this list. And she was trying to encourage and minister to them as best she can. One of the things that she did at this early stage was put Charles Wesley back on a right course. You wouldn't ever think he was on a wrong course, really. But he was influenced by the Moravians. Now, don't misunderstand me. The Moravians are very good people. But at this time, there were some within the Moravian group that got this idea, which they called stillness. Stillness. And it was this, that if you felt an absence of the Lord's presence, or you didn't feel you were getting very well in your Christian life, the thing was this, to be still and wait upon God to act. And that involved not praying. Don't pray for the Lord to help you, just be still. Don't read the Bible and wait for the Lord to speak, just be still. Just wait, and God will do something remarkable. No doubt they quoted the text, "Be still and know that I am God," but they were misinterpreting it. And apparently Charles Wesley was a bit enamored with this. But the Countess, with her tact and her prayers, got him back out of it. He put him back to be the normal Charles Wesley everybody knew sort of thing. But this was the sort of way that this woman helped the revival and the leaders of that revival to go on. Now, another thing that she did was quite remarkable for a woman in her position was, you know, that as the revival got going, there were groups of believers formed together. They called them societies in the first place. They didn't want to call them churches. They thought that was presumptuous. So they were societies of people gathering together to pray, to hear the word, to read the scriptures and so on. Now, she would very willingly, very happily go along to these meetings. Often they were the poorest of the poor, the lowest of the low, the ordinary of the ordinary. But she didn't stand on any ceremony at all. She would go along to these groups. Somebody in a little chapel gave her a private pew. They thought that was the way to treat somebody like this. She didn't complain. She went along and said, "Thank you very much." But she would have sat in a private pew or next to the man, you know, that was pulling the plow or whatever. She had no airs and graces about her at all. Another group of people that she got concerned about were convicts being sent to Australia or even condemned to death, and there were don't know how many crimes with the death penalty on in those days. But she would get alongside. Say there was a woman and her husband had been sent to Australia or somewhere. That woman would be destitute. They'd have nothing. And nobody would possibly want anything to do with it. But Lady Huntingdon found these people out and helped them. Very, very practical in her ministries, everyday life. Now, the spiritual side again. She wanted all the pulpits of the Church of England, this I made out of the church in Wales, I'm not sure, probably did as well. She wanted there to be an evangelical preacher there. When the people went on a Sunday, they wanted to hear the gospel. So she had all these people lined up, these potential preachers, and she would encourage them, persuade them, threaten them to go to this church or that church and fill the pulpit that day. She became like an extraordinary, do you use the word church secretary, the man who writes to the preachers or organizes the pulpit sort of thing. She became this extraordinary church secretary, appointing preachers to this place or that place all over the country, getting evangelical preachers into the pulpits of the established church. She never really left the established church. But after a while, she was running out of preachers. for one thing. And not only that, the authorities, again, of the Church of England were getting wise to what she was doing. She called all these men her chaplains. As a peer of the realm, she was allowed by law to have a chaplain. But she sort of interpreted a bit more widely than one. Because she had this position, she could have 50 chaplains or whatever. She had chaplains all over the place. But the authorities were getting wise to this. So she started to build her own, I'll say, chapels. You know what I mean. Independent meeting houses. And but she kept the Church of England happy, in a sense, although she believed it herself. The services were all conducted by the order of the Book of Common Prayer, and so on. And she made the articles of these little churches, the 39 articles of the Church of England. So they were there, and she was doing this. Very often, leading people in the Church of England, bishops, would come in incognito almost to listen to what was going on in these churches. And many of them came very favourably in the sense, you know, that they liked what they heard. And when she opened one of these little buildings, little churches in Bath, which was a very popular, posh sort of a place in those days where these people would go for a break, she had built into the little meeting house what she called a Nicodemus corner. And it was a little corner with a screen in front of it, where if you were a bishop or somebody like that, you didn't want anybody to know you were there, you could hide away in there and listen to the service quite comfortably. So she was a bit of a schemer, really. She, you know, she knew how to handle people in that sense. Now, she's got all these little churches round the place. They're all going under the name of her chaplains. When she does something else, which really upsets the apple cart there. She had this vision, really. She saw that in London, a huge auditorium had been built called the Pantheon, I should say, the Pantheon. It was a kind of a big building with rooms in it, that various functions. You could probably hire them out for different functions. Sometimes it served as a concert hall, but it was a very prestigious site in London, and she hired it. But the church authorities said she had broken the rules. I don't know why exactly, but it was the opportunity they'd been waiting for, because they wanted to say she couldn't have these little meeting houses under the auspices of the Church of England. They wanted to break that connection. And so, out of this, I mean, it was a great vision. It was like perhaps hiring the City Hall, you know, and having famous evangelical preachers to come and preach there. They stopped her from doing it. And in the end, she had to say that her chapels were independent or nonconformist. So that's how another denomination, as it were, began, the Countess of Huntingdon's Connection, which still exists to this day, you know. There are still places that go under that title, and not only in England, but some in America, and interestingly, some in Sierra Leone in Africa. There are still several Countess of Huntingdon Connection churches there. And so she did that. But then was the problem, following on from that, I better start looking at my watch because I've only got about an hour. I'll come to an end soon. She had to then think, well, it was going to get difficult to get these Church of England preachers to come now to these independent chapels. So what does she do? Give up? No. She forms the famous Trevecca Theological College in South Wales. She buys a building. It was an old building. It had actually been built in 1176. So when I say it was an old building, it was an old building. And there she opened it in 1768. It was opened by George Whitfield. And so it went on. Now, there are men coming now forward to study at the college. There's a lot you can say about this college. it wasn't sort of a starchy, just cerebral sort of college. They said that if you approached the place, you would hear the sound of prayer, because students that were not actually being lectured to would form themselves into little groups to pray in the woods and trees and fields that were round about. It was a very holy sort of place. And these men would be taught. And then on a Saturday, she kept horses. She had horses there, I should say, because on a Saturday, she would either send men out on foot. She had a 30-mile radius around the college of places she would send men to. They had to walk there. But I say she had horses, and they were for men to go further afield, up and down the country. She called them rounds. Rounds. She would send somebody, say, to Yorkshire, to a round that was up there. And what was a round? It was little causes here, there, in a certain radius, and they would, in the course of a week or 2 weeks, have to visit and encourage all those places. They did a round of various places like that. Now, the first president of the college was the famous John Fletcher of Madeley, a very, very godly man. And the main sort of lecturer was Joseph Benson. Again, you can get Joseph Benson's commentary. I've got a copy of it at home, and you need a lot of shells for it. It would take about that much Benson's commentary. Now, the problem was now, of course, you're going to get this famous... How long have I been talking now? Since 1 o'clock? Give me a few moments. There was the controversy between Wesley and Whitfield. They fell out. I can't go into all this, but there were some not very well thought out words of John Wesley at one of his conferences, whereby he gave the impression, though he didn't mean to, but he gave the impression that you could be saved by works. He was trying to balance and say, you know, faith without works is dead, but it was totally misunderstood. And he was foolish in the way that he tried to, you know, get out of it, really. And so there was a breakdown between the Wesley followers and the Whitfield followers. And really, both these men, Fletcher, a godly man of all godly men, and the other man, Benson, they had to resign their position. And so pretty well, the Lady Huntingdon took over the whole running of the show, as it were, herself. She didn't do the preaching, of course, but she appointed different men. But all that weight then came on her, the Trevecca College. I could just say she was interested in the work in America, South Carolina. People tell you that she had slaves there. You know, that's a big thing these days. They blow it out of all proportion. The college over there couldn't have survived without the monies that came from a plantation on which slaves were. When she finds out about it, or after a while, she brings all that to an end. And so that's a story that's been blown out of all proportion, I might just say. I haven't got time to go into it. She was planning to send missionaries at the end of her life to the continent. As I mentioned, she had mission stations established in the coast of West Africa and in the South Seas, and she had a particular burden for the American Indians, Red Indians. All this was part of her vision. She, as I say, she had power at the highest levels. The Archbishop of Canterbury at that time was holding masked balls in his palace, whatever they call it, and she... She got that stopped, so she knew when to strike. So anyway, we come to the end of her life and wrapping it up. Now, I did come across a writing about Selina by Cardinal John Newman. We don't normally refer to him. He lived not very far from where I live now. And I was intrigued to know what he said about her, so I looked it up. And he began like this. He called Lady Selina the great high priestess of a poisonous heresy. the great high priestess of a poisonous heresy. But having said that, he went on and said she was a representative in an evil day of the rich becoming poor for Christ. Well, you couldn't argue with that. She was, and there it was. But this woman, that was her text, really. There is but one foundation. There is one foundation on which a sinner like me can rest. They were virtually her dying words. For all that she did, for all the challenge of her life, for all her activity, but that she wasn't saved by works. There is but one foundation, and that is the truth of it. And that was her testimony, and that, in brief, if I dare say that, was her life. God bless each one.